Hello, and welcome to April's episode of the Our Science podcast, bringing you the latest highlights from around the Royal Society. I'm David Chapman.
And I'm Emma Woods. This month, we're bringing you the future of scholarly communication, the 2015 Leeuwenhoek Lecture, the Society's MP pairing scheme, and the biggest challenges of the 21st century. And that's just for starters.
Last month, scientists convened at the Royal Society to discuss the origin and evolution of the human brain. One school of scientists think that our brains evolved from a single ancestor, which was the forerunner of all brains in the animal kingdom. Others think that brains evolved more than once, separately in different species. We caught up with Dr. Frank Hirth, who organised the discussion meeting along with Professor Nicholas Strausfield, FRS, to find out more about this intriguing subject.
My name is Frank Hirth. I'm from King's College London. I'm one of the co-organisers of this meeting, which is entitled The Origin and Evolution of the Nervous System. And we have organised these meetings because in the last 15 to 20 years, there has been almost a paradigm shift in our understanding of evolutionary events. That is due to the fact that in several disciplines, we have gained and learned new facts, including new fossils have been found that have been thought to be impossible, that are fossils which show preserved brains. And these brains are up to 520 million years old. I'm still gasping because it's so unexpected. These are very complex brain. They are very old and forces us to shift further into the unknown when neurons and nervous systems evolved. We also have learned in the last 20 years that very different species that look very different, like a worm or an insect or a human, share genes in their genome that are very similar, and they seem to do very similar things. And they also help us to make inferences about how related these species are. There are some very surprising news that come out of that, for example, that Aachen worms, which do not look very nice, are very closely related to us, humans. And that's quite a surprise. And with that, we learned a very important lesson, that is, evolution is not going from simple to complex. There is no direction in evolution. That's a very, very fundamental insight into these studies. In evolution, you can lose complexity or characters. But this is also something that has been documented over the last 15 years.
So is there a disagreement between the scientists
on
this question?
Yes, there is a disagreement. And it may boil down to two disagreements, actually, which are interrelated. The first one is, has our brain anything to do with an insect brain or a worm brain? And there are people who argue it has. There is no relationship, means they independently evolved. And there are people like myself who propose the hypothesis that actually an insect brain and a human brain share a common ancestry. The second point of debate, I would say, is all brains are built out of nerve cells, also glial cells, but here the focus is on nerve cells. And there is disagreement whether nerve cells evolved once or several times. So there is a position by Leonid Moritz who says that neurons may have evolved five times, I think. I think he said five times. We can debate that. I'm not so sure about that. The question, of course, is how do we relate it to brain evolution?
The meeting certainly sparked some interesting discussions. Many of the talks were audio recorded, so if Dr. Hirth has piqued your interest, then listen to more by going to royalsociety.org/events and searching for nervous system.
On the 20th and the 21st of April, the Royal Society held the first of two 2-day meetings on the future of scholarly scientific communication. These meetings are at the core of our Publishing 350 programme, From Foundation to Future, that celebrates 350 years of philosophical transactions, while focusing firmly on the horizon and beyond. Recognising that scholarly publishing is in such a state of flux that the future might be very different, which is why these meetings refer to scientific communication rather than simply scientific publishing, A wide range of stakeholders from the UK and overseas were brought together to discuss areas of concern in publishing and the system of scholarly credit that depends on it.
In this first meeting, one of the issues under scrutiny was peer review, the process of certifying a scientific paper as being worthy of publication, and a process which is crucially carried out by a scientist's peers working in a similar field. We caught up with one of the speakers, the CEO of Public Library of Science, Elizabeth Marinkola, to get her take on how peer review might be improved in the future.
Could you tell me what you might want to talk about during the Royal Society's publishing anniversary meetings?
Yes, I think there are many issues around scientific publication and communication that are very important to talk about in this context and in this forum to honor the prestigious anniversary of the Royal Society. Many of them have to do with the process of publishing in itself. Peer review, I'm sure you've heard it said many times, it's like democracy, it's the worst form of review that exists except all the alternatives. But that's, I believe, a little bit of a cop-out. I think it's within our power, especially that now that we're in the electronic age, which offers all kinds of new opportunities to introduce technological innovations, to really look at peer review in order to capture all that is good about it and change all that is not good about it. So if we're able to have a deep, honest conversation about this, I'll be very pleased.
Is reform of peer review the most important element of the future of how science is communicated, do you think?
Not necessarily. I would certainly say it's one of the most important aspects. We still have, for example, access problems. PLOS was founded to deal with those access problems. And as much as we've been extremely pleased with the impact we've had on the business of scientific publishing, we have far to go. So I wouldn't necessarily say that peer review is the most or the only most important issue, but I would say it's one of the important issues that we have to grapple with as a community, yes.
Just to follow on from that, could you tell me how PLOS has introduced new models of peer review?
Well, yes. Our current approach is pretty traditional. And I would venture to say that it's not a model of innovation as it is now. But as we are envisioning it for the future, and I hope the not too distant future, it will improve many aspects of peer review. For example, we believe that peer review should be transparent, that reviews should be posted and signed so that people are accountable and can engage in the process of peer review. We think that peer review should be more inclusive. It shouldn't just be performed by a small number of reviewers, but rather the whole broad community should be able to contribute to an exchange of ideas around a scientific work. It should be continuous. It shouldn't be something that happens in a single point in time, but rather something that evolves as science evolves. We should provide better recognition for those who engage in peer review, develop some process for credit, for visibility, for advantage in some way, whether it's tangible or intangible, because peer review is considered a moral responsibility of researchers, particularly in the academic community. And because of that, they contribute a lot of time and effort, but the reward is almost none. And it makes people cynical about peer review. It makes people impatient about the process of publishing when they're asked to do so much. It's particularly intolerable when doing peer review for a commercial journal that's directly profiting from your work when you don't get any remuneration. So I think there are many opportunities in recognition for peer review, and I know there's a lot of interest in the UK as well. And finally, peer review simply needs to be faster and more efficient. As you know well, it's one of the major barriers to publication, and we've got to find a way to make it much more fast and much more efficient, which really relates to an earlier point I made about continuous review. So I do believe that the answer is going to be somewhere in the realm of pushing back review in the process, not necessarily waiting until everything's in final order before posting and sharing research. We do have to provide guarantees, parameters, assurances that a work hasn't been plagiarized, it's ethically sound, it's technically sound. In other words, it is science, but that doesn't mean that we necessarily have to wait for multiple peer reviewers to get back from their vacations or have the author resolve whatever new experiments they feel should have been done on the paper, et cetera, et cetera. So there's much room for improvement without throwing out the baby with the bathwater, without losing the integrity that peer review very importantly provides.
What do you say to those critics who say that objective peer review, for instance, risks just the publication record being flooded with papers of little significance?
If that happens, all the more power to the scientific community, as far as I'm concerned, because just because something's of, quote, little impact to somebody who may be reviewing it doesn't mean it may not be of great impact to somebody in a field closely aligned with the paper that's being published. The other thing is our search tools are so sophisticated now that it's less and less important how much total data is out there, because very few scientists anymore just pick up a journal and start reading the table of contents paper by paper. No, they're approaching the scientific literature as a whole and searching for materials that are relevant to them. So I would say for both those reasons, it's not an issue. When I'll just venture to say, when I thought you would use the term objective peer review, I was going to quickly say there is no such thing as objective peer review. That's one of the problems with peer review. As much as we like to believe and may sincerely try to be impartial when reviewing papers, in point of fact, it's extremely subjective. What's important, what's not important, what's interesting or not interesting, by definition, those are subjective selection criteria, and it's really, I think, the illusion that they're anything but is a barrier to us.
The meeting opened with an address by the Society's president, Sir Paul Nurse, which touched on the controversial subject of measurement of scientific quality and impact, something that has been the subject of much debate in recent times.
How does it differ, because it does, between different disciplines? And I sometimes worry that particularly the life sciences, which are often dominating discussions here, that there's not full enough recognition of the differences between different subject areas. That's something that the Academy needs to pay attention to. Is it better if peer reviewers are paid? Is there any evidence about that? One thing I find in these discussions is that there is often a dearth of evidence about what works and what doesn't work. That goes across the board. Do strong editors and publishing the reviews publicly, do they make peer review better? I personally think there's a real role for strong editors. I notice smiles going around the room because there's one or two who are sitting in this room. And strong editors who can put the reviewers in order, it may well be helpful. So that's one thing, peer review. A second issue that's relevant: measurement of research quality. Very important to science, important for career advancement, awarding of grants and so on. But the emphasis on the impact factor, as often the only metric, has its issues. It's clearly subject dependent. It is clearly something that can be manipulated. Made absolutely a parody when scientists are given cash incentives simply to publish in super high impact journals, as we see in certain countries. So are there other criteria about measuring the quality of work, such as actually reading the paper and deciding whether it's an interesting piece of work? I'd suggest there are other factors of that sort. And I get so cross when I'm in a reviewing committee and I read letters or hear people saying X has published in Nature, Science or whatever, as if this by itself means something. The laziness of senior colleagues in looking at this is completely extraordinary. And reading, making assessments is obviously important.
Part 2 of The Future of Scholarly Scientific Communication takes place from the 5th to the 6th of May. You can follow the debate on Twitter using the hashtag FSSC.
Our History of Science event series kicked off in March with Women Writing Science, hosted by Helen Arney. The series explores the history of science along with its impact on research and education today. Helen Arney was joined by Dr. Patricia Farrer, Dr. Emily Winterburn and Dr. Claire Jones to celebrate International Women's Day and delve into the question of how early women scientists use writing to further their careers.
Before the event started, we spoke to Emily to hear about that famous family of astronomers, the Herschels, and we discover the barriers that face women like Caroline Herschel to engage with science.
So what I'm going to talk about is a little bit about the Herschels, but sort of broadening it out to look at the way that women have been involved in science over the 19th century, and so how broader changes have affected how they've been able to do that, and what opportunities there were, but also what kind of restricted or shaped the particular kind of involvement they had with science.
So what kind of historical era are we thinking about?
Oh, about 19th century I'm focusing on. Specifically what I'm talking about is the way that specialisation has really shifted work, all kinds of work, but science, including science, moves out of the home. So things like, whereas at the beginning of the 19th century, a lot of women would get involved in science by working on a family enterprise. So like when William and Caroline work together on the science that they do, because their whole house is filled with telescopes and with apparatus and all sorts. And so it's relatively straightforward to be involved there. As science moves out of the home, it's just an extra barrier for women to get through. So another thing is, qualifications become more important, and again, that favours men rather than women, because women's education is just differently set up. The 19th century boys' education was all about kind of training, kind of analytical thinking, and it was about sort of training them to be able to deal with the public world. And girls' education was all about kind of really keeping it light. It was all about knowing lots and lots of things. So doing a bit of languages, a bit of art, a bit of history, but learning lots and lots of different things to a level where you could sort of, hold a conversation, but not necessarily to become an expert. Do you see what I mean? It was regarded as teaching you social skills and teaching you to be cultured. And you can see all of those skills being used. All those skills are then being applied to science, which I think is quite interesting. It's just a sort of... It's often written off as being biological differences, but actually, if you look at how they're educated, you can see all those supposed biological differences being sort of drummed into them from a very early age.
What would you like to say to a class of girls? Would you encourage them to do science?
I think you encourage them to do what they find interesting.
Yeah.
But yes, you do want to encourage... I mean, I guess that's where history has some place, is that you can... By recovering women from the history of science, you can say it for a long time it's never been a boys' subject, it's always been a subject that girls can do, so there's no reason why you shouldn't do it.
Was there anyone who particularly, a female scientist, that inspired you?
The people that were being promoted when I was at school were people like Marie Curie, where you think, oh my God, I couldn't possibly, the only person in history to get 2 Nobel Prizes. What? My choices as a physicist would be to become incredible, or I think that's what I find kind of interesting about looking at the forgotten women and the sort of the women that are in the middle, is that it actually gives you kind of...
Is there anyone you would recommend to feel inspired?
just because I've looked at them a lot, I would look at Caroline Herschel, because I think that she is very good at... She doesn't have these kind of great ambitions to be the greatest. You know, she has no role model. You know, how could she get that idea in her head? But she's very good at kind of using what she has to make them... You know, so she discovers comets, but she makes sure they get known. There was a period where people like Caroline Herschel would just be kind of exaggerating, you know, wow, she did all these amazing things and everybody was trying to kind of crush her reputation. And I think that isn't maybe that helpful, because it's still saying to succeed you have to be better than all men.
A full video recording of the Women Writing Science event, including the unveiling of a bust of Royal Society Research Fellow Dr. Lucy Green, is available on the Royal Society website. Also look online to see our upcoming events in the History of Science series.
In March, the Society held the 2015 Leeuwenhoek Lecture, given by a Fellow of the Royal Society, Professor Jeff Errington. Professor Errington was awarded the lecture for his work in relation to the cell cycle and cell morphogenesis in bacteria. During this lecture, he discussed how his work on bacteria in a cell wall deficient state are providing insight into their physiology and biochemistry.
Thank you for taking the time to answer a couple of my questions. And also congratulations on winning the 2015 Leeuwenhoek Lecture. If you could like to start off with, what does it mean to you to give this team lecture?
Well, I think it's an incredible accolade, and I'm really humbled by the whole experience. I'm following the footsteps of quite a lot of scientists who were my heroes growing up, and quite a lot of them are here tonight. So it's quite an exclusive club, and I'm actually delighted to be joining. I hope my lecture tonight lives up to the quality of my predecessors.
Can you give us a bit of an introduction to yourself and tell us what you're going to be talking about tonight? Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually a microbiologist. Well, I'm probably I started out as a geneticist, and then I got interested in developmental biology, and by chance, I ended up working on bacterial cells, and the bacteria fascinated me for the last 25 or 30 years. I'm particularly interested in very simple processes like the cell cycle. And a lot of what this boils down to in bacteria is how they regulate the synthesis of their cell wall, because it's a very special structure in bacteria. It's incredibly important because it's the target for the best of our antibiotics. And so I'm going to talk a bit about bacterial cell walls and how important they are and how they're important for antibiotics. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about some more technical stuff just for the microbiologists who are here, which will be about these funny bacteria that can actually live without a cell wall. And I'll describe those and the interesting things we found out about them. And then at the end, I'll try to tie this into an amazing area that we've got into very recently, which is to do with the origins of life. Because it turns out that these alpha-1 bacteria might be an interesting model for trying to understand how life first emerged on the planet.
These bacteria that are cell wall deficient, is that, do you find that in all types of bacteria? Because then you talked about, reading some of your, on the website, some of your research, you talk about bacteria switching from having a cell wall to being without a cell wall. Sort of, is that possible in all types of bacteria, or is it only a select few sort of types of bacteria that are able to do this or have no cell wall?
Yeah. Well, we originally saw that there was a long literature on alpha-1s, but a lot of it was done in the pre-molecular era. So it was very difficult in those days to actually, you know, characterise those cells. You couldn't tell definitively what kind of bacterium they came from. And so we decided to tackle this in the modern era using our favourite model organism, which is called Bacillus subtilis. And then having studied Bacillus subtilis for several years and found out some very interesting things about it, We then thought we'd broaden that out, and we started in the last few years to look at several other groups of bacteria, very diverse bacteria, and it looks as if a lot of the things that we found actually apply almost across the board, at least to groups of bacteria that probably diverged more than a billion years ago. So this ability to grow in the absence of cell wall seems to be something that's retained by a very wide range of bacteria. Mm-hmm. What we really don't understand yet, and we really like to understand, is the extent to which this might be important in pathogens, in infectious disease, because I think the jury is still out a little bit about on how important alpha-1s might be.
In terms of these alpha-1 bacteria being involved in maybe infectious diseases, do you think your approach is going to be trying to look at preventing them from switching to an L-form state, or will it be more sort of like trying to tackle them once they're actually in their L-form state?
I think the big challenge is actually just, you know, getting really convincing evidence that L-forms are important. And my view is, of course, I'm a scientist, I'm open-minded, but there are so many reports of L-forms in the old literature, that often in sort of chronic diseases, that it would surprise me if we didn't find L-forms somewhere. If we can positively identify and associate L-forms with disease, it's actually relatively straightforward to treat them, because they're still susceptible to lots of other antibiotics, you know, things that antibiotics that don't work on the cell wall, on protein synthesis or RNA synthesis and the like. So there are antibiotics you can cure L-forms, but you need to know that there's an L-form there in order to choose the appropriate antibiotic.
Following last month's podcast interview with Sir Paul Nurse and Lord Stern about the Academy's joint pre-election statement, we wanted to bring you another short clip from the event that they hosted here at the Royal Society. They were taking on the great challenges of the 21st century and offering their opinions on what can be done to tackle them.
I'm Nick Stern. I'm the president of the British Academy, and I'm a professor of economics at the London School of Economics.
I'm Paul Nurse. I'm president of the Royal Society, and I'm director of the Francis Crick Institute, a biomedical research institute in central London.
So we're here tonight at a joint event between the British Academy and the Royal Society. Would you like to tell me a little bit about it?
We're going to discuss some of the big challenges of the 21st century. Food and energy and health, and try to describe and discuss how our subjects, in the case of the British Academy, the humanities and the social sciences, in the case of the Royal Society, the sciences as a whole, how they can help us understand, tackle, rise to, respond to those big challenges, so that there's a chance to see our subjects at work, but try to share the world of ideas, intellectual inquiry, with the audience.
I think what Nick's explained there is how academia can help with great challenges. Quite often when these are discussed in the media and so on, they immediately think of the politics, sometimes the economics, but they don't always think about what it is that our intellectuals in society can contribute to dealing with these big issues. And sometimes, in fact, even obvious issues, you know, such as food, which we shall talk about,
yes.
You quite often see science, which has an enormous amount to contribute, just sort of slipping off at the end of the agenda there. So I think one important message, at least for me, is that we need to make use of our intellectual capital across the board in a whole wide variety of intellectual pursuits, all have something to contribute tackling the great problems that face the world.
If you take food and pursue that one for a little bit, roughly, we don't know exactly, but something between 30 and 50% of food is wasted. In rich countries, mostly it's after it's bought. In developing countries, it's mostly between the harvest and the market. That's enormous. Food demand might go up in the next 35, 40 years, we don't know exactly, but maybe 70%. Well, if we're wasting 30 to 50%, then but a big chunk of the response could be tackling waste. On the other hand, it looks as though quite a lot of the growth in yield that we saw during the Green Revolution, particularly associated with wheat and rice, seems to be fading away. And we may need a big boost in productivity of cereals. Then we have to ask ourselves, how could that happen? Well, the agricultural sciences, the biological sciences, the engineering management of water, they'll kick in strongly in helping to understand that. So that big challenge of feeding a growing population is very clear. You're going to need all the social sciences, understanding how people behave, all the way through to the more techie part of understanding how you can boost yields.
What Nick's emphasising there is the multidisciplinary approaches that are needed to what is actually quite a serious problem. there's around 1 billion on the planet today who have less calories than they need every day. And frankly, that just isn't right. And that issue is going to get worse as the population increases. And often you find when people discuss this sort of issue, they tend to talk about just one aspect of it. I mean, for example, they might talk about the economic drivers, or they might talk about political issues. They might talk about GM and how you produce better crops and so on, how you deal with fertilizer and water and all of these things. The reality is that actually you need action across the board. But I want to say something else. I think that given the size of this problem, we need to look at every possible solution to be able to deal with it. And we should not reject possibilities simply due to concerns perhaps of the Islington chattering classes that they do not like certain things when they have never had an empty stomach in their lives. And what I'm thinking of here is issues around GM crops, which have been shown to be completely safe, have been elevated to a point where it is difficult to devise new crops using this sort of technology, which may really help the starving in the world. It's absolutely not the only solution. But I think we have to ask ourselves, is it morally right to not use these sorts of technologies when they may have something to contribute to alleviate the suffering of humankind? And I feel very strongly that we need to carefully look at what is possible and not be over-influenced just because of fads that some have, and which I'm afraid we see even in some of our NGOs who are frankly not thinking clearly about this issue.
This month, we opened applications for our pairing scheme. Each year, we pair 30 research scientists from academia and industry with UK parliamentarians and civil servants. By spending time together in Westminster and at the researchers' lab, participants get the opportunity to learn about each other's work and gain insight into how research can help to inform policy.
Dr. Sadia Ahmed, a research scientist who took part in last year's scheme, kindly agreed to tell us about her experience of spending a week in Westminster.
Hi Sadia, thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for agreeing to tell us about your experience of the week in Westminster part of last year's scheme. So I was wondering if you could begin by sort of introducing yourself and telling us a bit more about the research that you do.
Yeah, so I'm a computational ecologist and I work for Microsoft Research as a postdoc at the moment. My research mainly focuses on the interface between the human world and the environmental world, so basically looking at how we are altering the environment through land use change, through putting infrastructure in, reducing biodiversity, stuff like that, and the impacts that has on the environment. So how that's reducing biodiversity levels, how it's influencing ecosystem services and stuff like that.
Okay, and could you tell us sort of why you were interested in the pairing scheme and what motivated you to apply?
Yeah, so what really interested me in the scheme was that my work has a lot of policy interface in some ways, because it's about how we affect the environment. So part of that is how can we minimise and mitigate the effects we have, and obviously one of the ways to do that is through policy. And so I was really keen to find out about how I could engage more with the policy domain, and the scheme just seemed like it would line up perfectly for that.
Okay, great. You paired with your local MP, Julian Hippett, mm-hmm. who is quite well known for having an interest in science, which probably worked quite well. Can you tell us what it was like shadowing him as part of the scheme?
I think the only way to describe it is really, really intense. I mean, he was on his feet most of the time, going from meeting to meeting, and it was really, really hectic. I mean, one of the things that really, really shocked me was, you know, he had a briefing meeting with, I think it was an analyst, but in the first 15 minutes, they had managed to cover about 8 different topics. And I was just thinking, if this was an academic meeting, we'd still be on the pleasantries at this point. And it's just the rate at which they get through stuff, it's really, really hectic.
In terms of being paired with an MP, having been on the scheme, do you think that you would recommend going with an MP compared to, say, maybe a peer or a civil servant? Do you have an opinion on that?
I mean, talking to other people who had been on the scheme, whether you were paired with a civil servant or a peer or an MP, I think everybody got something out of it, and so I think that regardless who you're paired with, you'll get something good. So I don't think it matters who you're paired with, you still get a lot of insight into different aspects of how things work.
Great. You've already said you spent quite a lot of time when you were shadowing Julian, sort of going to meetings and briefings. What other activities did you do during your week in Westminster, and which one was your favourite?
Well, there are a lot of things organised, both by the Royal Society and by Julian. And I also managed to organise a separate meeting with somebody in post, which was really good. So we had things like select committees, so actually attending real select committees. There was a mock select committee that was set up. We had a workshop for SAGE, which is the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies. And I think that was probably my favourite workshop because it was really interactive and it actually gave a real insight into how science does influence policy or influence decisions. So I thought that was really good. But there were just lots and lots of things, obviously, that we did. And I think the select committees were really good as well. So
great. Can you remember what the SAGE meeting was on, a particular emergency?
I think it was on flooding. It was based on the floods that we had last winter. And they basically said that they basically presented the information as if it was new and that there was going to be a cabinet meeting of COBRA. And we had to sit down and say, well, here's all the evidence, what do we do? And then as you went through the workshop, they'd present new pieces of information. And it was really good.
What do you think scientists will learn if they take part in the scheme this year?
I think they'll get a really good insight and an understanding into how, first, British policy in general works, but also how science feeds into that policy and basically how all the cogs in the machine work. And I think that's really important to understand if you're going to have any sort of influence on that.
Do you think it's now easier to work out how you could apply your research findings to the policy world?
I think that's definitely the case. And also it's sort of opened up links almost to other ways that I could influence it. So we got introduced to charities and not quite NGOs, but basically other institutions that we can contact to get involved with things. So it's not just going perhaps directly to your MP or something. It's having access to that whole network, which I thought was really useful.
If you'd like to find out more about the scheme and how to apply, then visit royalsociety.org/pairing-scheme.
And finally, our Why Science this month comes from the 2015 Leeuwenhoek Lecture awardee, Professor Jeff Errington.
Yeah, I think it was to do with trying to understand, you know, who we are and where we come from, you know, why we're here. And I had a sort of vague idea that I would like to, that was probably one of the most interesting and exciting things you could do with your life. And so I realised the only way to really tackle that would be to get a career in science. And that's what I set out to pursue. It's been an amazing, I would recommend it to anybody, career in science.